You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
For African people, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God-goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization. And they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us so we would never forget. To those ancestors, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation to our ancestors, because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, ashe. We pour libation to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve. And at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent. Leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diasporas, both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because over time they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that described them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation too to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists, the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation, those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation to our children and those yet to be born, for they are the ones that you must teach, and you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, for they will call your name in all eternity. To our children we pour libation, ashe, ashe, ashe.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Let America be America again. Langston Hughes. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain seeking a home where he himself is free. America was never America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great, strong land of love where never kings connive nor tyrants scheme, that any man be crushed by one above. It was never America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath. But opportunity is real and life is free. Equality in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark? And who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I am the poor, white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog eat dog, of mighty crush the weak. I am the young man full of strength and hope, tangled in that ancient endless chain of profit, power, gain, of grab the land, of grab the gold, of grab the ways of satisfying need, of work the men, of take the pay, of owning everything for one's own greed. I am the farmer, bondsman to the soil. I am the worker, sold to the machine. I am the Negro, servant to you all. I am the people, humble, hungry, mean, hungry yet today, despite the dream, beaten yet today. Oh, pioneers, I am the man who never got ahead. I am the poorest worker bartered through the years yet. I am the one who dreamt our basic dream in the old world while still a serf of kings, who dreamt a dream so strong, so brave, so true, that even yet its mighty daring sings in every brick and stone, in every furrow turned that's made America the land it has become. Oh, I am the man who sailed those early seas in search of what I meant to be my home. For I am the one who left dark Ireland's shore and Poland's plain and England's grassy lay and torn from black Africa's strand to build a homeland of the free. The free? Who said the free? Not me? Surely not me. The millions on relief today. The millions shot down when we strike, the millions who have nothing for our pay, for all the dreams we've dreamed and all the songs we've sung and all the hopes we've held and all the flags we've hung, the millions who have nothing for our pay except the dream that's almost dead today. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has yet been and yet must be, the land where every man is free, the land that's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain must bring back our mighty dream again. Sure, call me any ugly name you choose. The steel of freedom does not stain from those who live like leeches on people's lives. We must take back our land again. America, oh yes, I say it plain. America was never America to me. And yet I swear this oath, America will be, out of the rake and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of grab, of stealth and lies, we the people must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, and the endless plain. All the stretch of these great green states and make.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep and greetings, sisters and brothers. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank, and I am your host, William Rogers. Thank you so much for, joining us this evening. We are looking forward to a very dynamic and empowering discussion about the history of our people. Again, we thank you. We are here every Tuesday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time. And we are broadcasting on the Time for an Awakening Network. We are a part of a group of radio programs that are addressing the causes of our people. And so we are so happy to be here. This is a call-in format. So today, as our discussion begins to mount, you have the opportunity to give us a call and stress your opinion on this subject, or you could simply call to ask a question. But we welcome you to do that, and we look forward to you doing that. So again, the number is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. And you will reach us here. We have a great program that we sort of prepared for you this evening. We have just recently had a highlighting of that horrible incident at Tulsa, Oklahoma. So what we thought we would do here at the Black Reality Think Tank is to kind of let everybody go through their discussions and let the winds blow, and then see if we can come back and pick up on some things that we could add to that discussion. Obviously, nothing new, just simply add to the discussion that may not have been highlighted in the way that it could have been, but we want to look at it somewhere. Somebody has addressed it, but at least we want to go back in and focus on some things that were more downplayed than they should have been. And so we're going to do that. We know of the horror of that situation and the story, the deaths, the destruction of property, human life, the racism. We understood all that. We looked at that. But there are some other factors that we want to talk about tonight. So tonight we call this program The Button Naked Truth Concerning the Tulsa Uprising. And so we want to explore the real deal message. There's a message to all of this that is not quite as announced as it should be behind this uprising and what was going on. And like we said in our promotion, everything that we do has a hidden hand. There's a hidden hand in all incidents. And a lot of times it's never revealed within the time that we are looking at. Sometimes it may take years and years and years before that hidden hand emerges. And so very clearly we want to pinpoint what we think might be a hidden hand and discuss it with our panel and our audience and give you an opportunity to respond to that as well. So that's one of the things that we're going to do, and we're going to do it from a historical perspective, and because we do believe that history has the power of revealing some things today. So that's our program, that's our agenda, that's what we're going to do, and we're going to go with that, and we look forward to your input, the input of our audience, as we always do. I'm very, very happy that you're here to join us, those of you who are here so far. And I say to you, our listening audience, the internet audience, by all means, you are welcome to join this conversation. 215-490-9832. And you can call us at any time and stress your opinion and objections. And so we're going to deal with some issues tonight that you may have known about or you may not. But anyway, we're going to talk about them and see what we feel and what we can garner from this the whole idea of it. So, okay, at this time, you know, we do our ancestral profile. We always like to support our ancestors. We stand on their shoulders. We beckon them sometimes to join us in what we are doing in our work. And by all means, we know that we could not have been if it had not been for them. And so we recognize that, and we'll always recognize that. So tonight I want to talk about a brother that's very relevant to the subject. Some of you may have heard of him, some of you may not. The one thing that we know about the Tulsa situation and the Tulsa uprising, that it was based on this community in Oklahoma, very, 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 very successful. And so our profile tonight is one of the brothers that was very successful in this initiative and had done very well for himself during this particular time. His name is Dr. Andrew Cheston Jackson, Dr. Andrew Cheston Jackson. And he was able to cross over from the color line and had begun to live a life very successful in his community. And he was a very powerful brother. He was said to be one of the most able black doctors in America. Now, the biographers didn't say that, and none of the other folks, The persons that recognized that were the Mayo brothers of the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota and throughout the country. But Minnesota, I know, is their central headquarters. But they said that Dr. Jackson was a gift to our lives and to America. And his patients and his practice was supported by all races. Everybody went to Dr. Jackson. And he was a very light-skinned mulatto brother. And so I guess in some cases they might have taken him for as a Caucasian, but he treated many, many people. And he was obviously one of the most prominent figures that was killed in the riot. Dr. Jackson, who was a 42-year-old surgeon, he was living on Detroit Avenue in the Greenwood section. And according to Jackson's white neighbor, who was a former police commissioner and a retired judge, John Oliphant, he said Dr. Jackson had raised his hand to surrender to a group of white men when two of them shot him dead in what Oliphant called cold-blooded murder. He was born to Captain Townsend D. Jackson and his mother, Sophronia, in Memphis, Tennessee, in February of 1879. Dr. Jackson was the youngest of three children. Both of his parents were former enslaved Africans, with Sophronia being from Texas, and his father from Georgia. The couple met and married in Memphis a few short years before their daughter, Minnie Mae, was born in 1875. Dr. Jackson graduated from Meharry Medical College in Nashville, Tennessee. He practiced for a while in Tulsa and Claremore, Oklahoma. Then he trained as a surgeon in Memphis, Tennessee. His work was such that he attracted the attention, as I said earlier, of the Mayo brothers. And one of the things that he did, he was a specialist in chronic diseases and surgery for women. Dr. Jackson lived on what was one of the most exclusive blocks of all of the Greenwood. His neighbors included Booker T. Washington High School principal, who was E.W. Woods, who was also an outstanding Tulsonian as well, the Tulsa Star publisher, A.J. Smitherton, and the physician, R.T. Bridgewater. He was a member of that neighborhood of people. Dr. Jackson, I just want to ask our listening audience, would you please mute your phones? I am able to hear a distraction in the background, and it does stop us sometimes. Please mute your phones to all of our audience. Thank you so much. Dr. Jackson created surgical tools, very innovative surgical tools that are still being used today. And his technology and advancement was well ahead of his time. Surgical students the world over have been influenced by his great surgeon's contribution to the medical community. Why Dr. Jackson, one of the gentlest men, would have been singled out is not very clear. Perhaps he was mistaken for the more outspoken Smitherman or Bridgewater. Perhaps he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. That riot in Tulsa had all but died down, Oliphant said, when Dr. Jackson came walking out of his house toward the crowd of men with his hands in the air, saying, I want to go with you, he said. And he was saying that because he knew that there were bodies and people that were hurt, and he wanted to go with them to see if he could provide treatment and medical care. At that point, about a body of about seven men who were all armed intercepted him, and two young fellows fired on him. He fell to the ground, and one of the men shot him again. Others detail that Dr. Jackson died tragically in the 1921 Tulsa race riot, what they call the Holocaust, the worst of the so-called riots in the early 20th century, gunned down by a 14-year-old teenager while surrendering at his residence. Dr. Jackson's lacking medical attention eventually bled to death. His killers were never identified specifically and identified enough in a way to have them prosecuted. And as history moved on, they went away free, having killed one of the most brilliant people in that city. So, again, we thank him and we give honor to this ancestor, Dr. Andrew Cheston Jackson. All right, folks, tonight we're going to talk a little bit about that Tulsa situation, but we're going to expand that conversation. We're not just going to deal with Tulsa. We're going to ask ourselves some real basic questions about all of this and kind of get an understanding, maybe something about the state of Oklahoma and what it was and why is it that, because there's some questions that I remember somebody asked me not long ago. Why did they burn Tulsa and not some of those other places that were around? And I think that what we're going to talk about tonight are some reasons possibly that could be said why they didn't burn some of the other cities that had been very successful. Why they hadn't burned some of the other cities that were successful and chose simply Tulsa. And I think that's a very important element. And so tonight we're going to get into that. As you know, this was the 100th anniversary celebration of that awful day, this massacre, which was orchestrated very clearly by a white mob against African Americans and their businesses in Tulsa, Oklahoma. There's been a lot of research done on this situation from the past, a lot of modern research that has revealed some very interesting things that we want to talk about. These men that were involved, these Caucasian men that were involved in this horror, were deputized by their claims to coercive power and justice. And these group of armed men, this mob, was both a trial judge and the executioner, killing hundreds, looting and burning even homes and businesses. We know the story. We've seen the images. Members of the mob acted on their own sense of justice, what they call justice. So the question is, what justice? What is it? What about the justice for the survivors and descendants of these murdered individuals? Justice for people of African ancestry in the United States, as Langston Hughes wrote, what is America to me? What does that really mean? And let America be America, because it never has been America for us. And this situation clearly brought this out. So this deputized mob and the police support exercise in Tulsa were part of slavery's ongoing situation. Now, let's talk a little bit about Oklahoma. I want to do that first. I want to get into a little bit of Oklahoma first and talk about some of the history of that. And then at that point, we'll open up the audience and let you give your opinion of some of these things that had happened. Well, first of all, there were a lot of African towns, black African towns, in the state of Oklahoma. Greenwood was a community. It wasn't a town. But there were a lot of actually black cities that existed in that Tulsa area and in the town. And let's just give some names of a few of them. There was one city called Langston. There was another one called Redbird. There was a Tallahassee. There was a Taft, Oklahoma. A Summit, Oklahoma. There was a Grayson. Rentlessville, Oklahoma. Vernon, Oklahoma. And Tatum's, Oklahoma. And there were some others as well, too. But these are documented places and points that you can always go back and look at and take a look at, but they existed. Now, the question is why? What happened? What was that all about? Well, first of all, any history that you are going to write, particularly dealing with the South and dealing with the early 18th and 17th in history, 17th century history, you will have to bring the Native Americans into that discussion. And we have not done that historically. We have overlooked the Native American relationship. We've heard some things. You know, obviously, we know that many of the Native American nations held the Africans in captivity as well. They were slaveholders, particularly the Cherokee. The Cherokee were hard, cruel slaveholders, sometimes worse than the ones that that were here from England. But nevertheless, the history has to speak about the whole idea of the Native American involvement and the Native American relationship. And so that has to be taken in consideration here. Oklahoma was a very strong Native American territorial system. And so as you celebrate this particular incident that we are talking about, you would never be able to do it successfully and as completely without taking into consideration, the Native American involvement. Basically, the area that would become the city of Tulsa was settled in 1836, and it was settled by the Creek Nation from Alabama. The Creek Nation of Native Americans from Alabama are the ones that settled that area. They had been forcibly removed from other southeastern indigenous nations by the U.S. government at gunpoint and genocidally pushed onto what we all know as the Trail of Tears, where thousands died also. Not as well known is that the enslaved Africans dug the trail to so-called Indian territory, and many of them died as well. There were black settlements along that Oklahoma area, which converged with Kansas settlements. There were a lot of black towns in Kansas as well. There were a group called the Black Exoduses. That's another whole very rich history, who thought this territory could be the site of an all-black nation, free of whites and full of black discrimination. So that's the beginning of that Oklahoma area. Many of the Africans who had escaped down into Florida would mix with a native nation called the Seminoles, and that they would then form together and move into the Oklahoma area. So there were five basic Native American nations in the Oklahoma area that embraced the Tulsa surrounding. There were the Cherokee Nation, the Choctaw, the Chickasaw, the Cree, and the Seminoles. They had all settled in that area, and they had settled as a free and independent people. And what they would do is basically, those who had used the labor of Africans and would eventually be able to, who had kept them in captivity in a lot of ways, would eventually release them and give them an opportunity to find their own. The Native American system of captivity was a lot different than obviously the Europeans. In a lot of cases, in those stories that we hear, they were married to a lot of the Native Americans, married within the race. They were mixed in many, many ways. And that's where a lot of African people today get their, their Native American heritage. But nevertheless, this Tulsa area had these five Native nations that were occupying that territory. And they turned over a lot of that property and the area to the Africans so that they could settle. Tulsa was one of the areas that they did that in, and they were able to create very strong and independent communities. And these communities were successful. Oklahoma had discovered oil, and it had become a boom town. And there was work and labor. A lot of the Africans obviously didn't own the oil, but they worked where those areas that where they had to be drilled, and they worked in those rich nations, rich areas of the oil drilling system, and so they took part of that. And obviously the Tulsa area would be just one of the strongest because that was it. But the other towns like Langston and Boley, and all of that is would begin to build and operate strong. Oklahoma became a state in 1907, And most of the native groups and Europeans, could you please, ladies and gentlemen, silence your mic again? I really ask. Someone is moving their microphone around, and it's really distracting. I would truly appreciate if you would do that. Thank you. So in the case of this early development of this area, there were over 29 black towns that were established in Oklahoma. And I said, the most well-known was Langston and Boley, and there's another whole history behind them. The earliest history of the state convergence was slavery and the extension of racial capitalism into what we so-called Indian Territory. The white Southern Confederates began to arrive in post-Civil War period. They settled their racist foundation, and they brought all of that ugly attitude that they had into the state to come and work that oil. They flowed into Oklahoma, bringing that venom with them, that anti-black neighborhood, and oil was discovered throughout that area. It became known as the oil capital of the world. Now, Tulsa, Black Tulsa, what they called it at the time, was deemed Black Wall Street because of its prosperity. This is the kind of the surface piece of the story. There was a business elite and a majority working class servicing the oil rich of Tulsa, and that's what they were. They were servicers. They were certainly were very high and notable entrepreneurs, and they were being drawn from other places that were where the racism was a little bit more harsher and more prolonged over time, like Alabama. It was a prosperity town born of struggle, and not because of integration into the white capitalist oil dynasties. That's not what made it good. This oil fueled the enormous wealth of a white oil elite. And the evidence, that's the recent research that has been done, suggests some of it found its way into the Black Tulsa area of Greenville. The heart of the prosperity was found in this business district called Greenville. And so by 1919, after World War I, they had this race riots of Reds called the Red Summer. The great historian Rafael Loring wrote a book. He called it the Nadir of the Negro. And he talked about all of that horror that they brought into the system. A white lynch mob formulated after a young black man named Dick Rowland, you know that story, was accused of an assault. Now, there has been some historical research that found that it wasn't all of that, that actually Dick Rowland may have been dating that white girl in the past, and that this was some confrontation between them. And there's this rumor, now as a historian, you know, we have to go on fact, but we still have to look at the possibilities as well, that they were simply arguing, she was mad about something, and this is how it got out of hand. Somebody overheard them arguing in the elevator, and as a result of that, they went back and told other people. But the story went that as he was getting in the elevator and slipped, and he grabbed her to catch his balance, and she screamed rape. Well, as I said, the other evidence around is saying that that's not what took place, but again, it's not able to prove. She never confessed the story. She did recant it in the latter part and say that he did not do it, he did not rape her. But anyway, this incident brought that angry venom out of the woodworks, and it began to create some extremely horror. Brother Ricks, if you could just mute that your video part of this, it's okay to listen, but you need to take that video off, if you could, please, because it would affect the settings if you don't. Brother Ricks, the video, you have your, just sort of mute your video camera, because you have the video on. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's down at the bottom with them. There we go. Appreciate it. Okay. All right. So anyway, the Dick Rowland situation is really what brought on all of this, and then the murder. And then the thing about the Greenwood Rising. It does talk about the intergenerational wealth that might have been passed on to a lot of people if this did not have happened, and what the possibilities of that would have been if that could have been passed on. Now, you must remember, we said that this was a Native American land, and the Native Americans were always around. It wasn't didn't mean that they had gone anywhere. So the Native Americans have to also were a part of the this whole crisis. Now, whether they participated with the whites or not, we don't know. There is some evidence that some of those Native American nations did favor more of the European involvement, whereas others didn't. They favored the African in a lot of ways, and so they supported and tried to help the Africans in this crisis. And then some of the other Native Americans that were there. By this time, the whole thing had been crisscrossed into each other. And if you're doing the researching this, you would obviously have to look at a lot of that rich history of the Native Americans and get the position in their perspective on this whole idea. But now here's the bottom line. Here's the hidden hand. And here's what the historians left out in the early part. Most of the black men that lived in this area in Tulsa were upright, proud, freestanding black men who had wanted nothing to do with Caucasians. These men were armed. They had armed themselves with the potential of knowing what could happen. They were strong. They were forthright. And they were prepared to deal with anybody who would mess with their community. So that was a group that was organized. One other area that had been left out is that area also had a large community of very spiritual Africans, people that we know today and call root doctors. There were many of them. There was one whose name was Wilhelm, and he was a part of the plantation called the Burbage Plantation that was actually owned by Andrew Jackson's family. So he was there. And then there were others who practiced that. There was one outstanding brother. They used to call him John the Baptist. And he also practiced roots and so forth. But they were very successful with it as well, and had made money and had built businesses and owned real estate and some of the other areas. But nevertheless, what they didn't tell us, that when this situation happened with the elevator and how all of that happened, a group of black men got together and armed themselves. And they armed themselves in a way that said, don't mess with this boy. The organization was called the African Blood Brotherhood. There were several incidents of them putting their arms together and standing up in defense of the case. Well, obviously, the Europeans did not want that to happen. And there were some exchanges. There were some fires. There were some whites that were killed that ended up having to be shot because of this. One of the documentations for a lot of this was a newspaper that was published around that time called The Crusader. Now, The Crusader told a story about the African Blood Brotherhood. And we know that from this group, these brothers did not play. And they were prepared to fight. Well, when you do that, you know what happens in the Caucasian mind. And they have to wipe that out. They have to stop that. They will then, you know, their violent nature will obviously spill over into the situation where they would fight you and they will fight back. But these brothers were worried to do that and were prepared to do that. And as a result, they took aim at this particular situation, and that spurred them on in a lot of ways to become as destructive and as violent as it was. But those other African towns, those other towns in Oklahoma also did the same thing. And it was well known historically that you don't mess with that. Hollywood has always, played things over and messed up stuff and trying to do all the create these stories. They try to write our history, but we have to go through and pull it. They're doing a story on Boley. It's going to be done very soon. And as you know, they took on the Tulsa story in that HBO movie called The Watchmen. The Watchmen was about the Tulsa race situation. But they are planning to do a movie on Boley. Now, the question with Boley and some of those other areas, there were a lot of banks being robbed along those little small towns out of Kansas and Oklahoma in those areas. And a lot of the, some of those Pretty Boy Floyd and all of them were robbing banks. And it is well known that Pretty Boy Floyd told his group, don't mess with Boley, because the blacks, he didn't call them blacks, you know what he called them, the blacks were, they had the bank, they don't have a lot of money, but they got guns and they're ready to kill. So let's avoid Boley. Leave that alone. And there's the documentation that says that he did say that. But nevertheless, Hollywood has been playing around with these Oklahoma towns, but it gives you a good idea and understanding of that, the resistance that they had. That's how they would survive. And one other thing I found, too, one of the Africans that were part of that very influent community of Greenville also owned an airplane, and they were talking about planes dropping bombs out the window. Well, there were whites with it because they said this was a prosperous place. This was oil money. Well, there were blacks that had airplanes, too, and we never picked that part of the story up. We never get into the depth of the wealth system that the Africans had. This created envy among the Caucasians, and particularly when they stood up to defend themselves, that really drew them into the need to have a fight and erase that. The fact is that the Africans were successful in a lot of their resistance, but they were outnumbered. As Walter Mosley wrote in his book, they were outgunned and outnumbered. And as a result, we saw what would happen. But that movie that's coming out called Boley, it's a planned series about the all-black town of Oklahoma, Okwuegee County, I think if I'm pronouncing it right, is supposed to be another black western town that they're going to deal with. The Boley event series will be produced by a woman named Diane Houston, who did the movie When We Rise, and the producer will be Rudy Langlace, who did Hurricane and Sugar Hill. And so it will be on cable, and it'll kind of display a little bit of what the power these little small towns had and how important that they are, which lets you know maybe it's why you saw some of the energy you saw going into destroying Greenville. Because in a lot of cases, there was a lot of interaction back and forward between the Greenville community, Boley and Langston and some of those others. These folks were making money. They were doing well. Children, they had schools. They had built law practices, banks, and they were doing what you're supposed to do as a community. But nevertheless, you can imagine the anger that brought to a group of whites, just like they did down in Florida and other places. I think the reason what we see and the reason that it did not happen in some of the other cities like Durham. Durham is also a black Wall Street, had an area, very influent as well. It wasn't necessarily like that because the blacks did live in a certain section of Durham called Hayti. And Hayti is believed to be had the name of Haiti, all black. But there was a reason. Durham was built more on a paternalistic realm. It was tobacco. Most of blacks worked in the tobacco factories, and they did very well. Those who worked in the tobacco factories made money. They were the more affluent blacks of Durham, North Carolina. You also had textile mills in Durham. But the people who owned those mills were very paternalistic, and they would never have allowed some of that to have happened, you know, from their standpoint. I remember I was talking to a friend, because Durham was my hometown, and we were talking. I asked him, had he ever seen a Ku Klux Klanman in a robe burning a cross anywhere in Durham? And we were told no, that you had to go out into the county. And I know that I never saw that. I knew it existed. I knew that there were places in North Carolina that did burn crosses, and the Klan did walk down the street in robes. But I never saw a Klansman in Durham in the 18 years that I was there before I left with a robe on. I only saw that in magazines and stuff, because the Duke family would not have allowed that to happen, because obviously they needed to put on a certain facade, because they were trying to, Durham was supposed to be an experiment that blacks could live successfully among whites and use that depending system and do well. But that's another whole story. We get into that, because obviously that was not true. And eventually they destroyed the Black Wall Street by running a highway through the middle of it. So that happened as well. But anyway, these small towns in Oklahoma, that's kind of the story. And I think the driving point is, number one, anytime black men stand up to fight back, they will be wiped out in America. Bottom line, they may be successful in some areas, but they will never be able to live to tell the story. And this story has been watered down. We did not hear too much of the African Blood Brotherhood in a way that we should have, but it did exist. These brothers were strong. They were fearful of them, and they fought back and tried to save their homes, but they couldn't. The intensity of the racism from whites was just too much. And remember, these whites that we're talking about are the ones that had moved into Oklahoma to deal with that oil and to deal with that. And also, in some cases, the suggestion is that the Native Americans were also able to use that as a way of fighting back. There were some of the Native American nations that were angry that their land and a lot of the land that they had been given over to the blacks to do things. And some of the other nations that did do it, they were in dispute with each other. The Cherokee were the worst for Africans. They were, as we said earlier, they were the worst of all in terms of their treatment. There's a lot of books that have been written on the relationship, the Native American relationship with the African American community. There's a long list of them, and you could just simply Google the books, and you can find out what some what some of them are. But I think my point tonight is this. Any history that you have to talk about, African people fighting for liberation and doing the things we were trying to do to build communities and keep things together, you cannot do that by leaving the Native Americans out. They have a lot big role to play, sometimes negatively, sometimes positively. And that's left out of this history because, as I said, Oklahoma was a Native American land. And as a result of that, Greenwood was given and allowed, the African-Americans were allowed to operate and build this community. Whites got angry and decided to go in there and tear it down. And that's some of the history. And the other thing is that we didn't passively sit by and let this done. We know that from the African Blood Brotherhood, that we did not passively stand aside. A lot of times that's not played in history. They don't tell you how we fought back. They didn't tell you the little secret ways. And a lot of it was done underground. And history does that. And then the other part is that this Dick Rowland thing and this white girl may very well have been something else. But it was just used as a means of being able to set this fire off and move forward. And so I want us to think about that a lot of times when we're assessing history. And we are looking at history, you know, there's a lot of stuff working. There's a lot more than what we see, a lot more than what we talk about. And in one of our programs coming up, I want to talk about that that whole thing with the spiritual guys, these guys, the root doctors, and the role that they played. And, you know, in the American version of that, they called it voodoo, so forth. But this was simply African spiritual systems. And they were able to use stuff and do stuff with it, very much like the in the Haitian Revolution. And so there was always a attempt that the Europeans knew that. And when they were singled out, they were shut down quickly. And if you know, the Native American spiritual system is like that as well. So sometimes they can work together and do things together that may very well be able to be a reason why some of these things were shut down so quickly. A lot of the early black church has a history in the root doctor system, the African Badoon system, right here in America. A lot of it. And it has to be dealt with, researched. And a key to that sometimes is just who's going to do it and where the information going to come from. And unfortunately, Hollywood has been the only one that's been doing that, and that's kind of been a joke in order to do that. But I think that we should remember that very clearly. It was horror, no doubt about it. And even getting down to the question of whether it was a massacre or just warfare, because it was the city of Greenwood that struck itself. Now, I want to hear what our audience has to say about your understanding and what you have learned from your researching this and listening to some of the stuff. Most of the information that we get now is coming off of YouTube, TV, and some of these other means that really are not whole. But there's a large body of new research being done, looking at letters, looking at discussions that were going on, looking at ownership of property and who held the deed to certain pieces of land, those kinds of things that offer a lot more of a clear understanding of why. And I think the main reason that this, and I'm going to keep quiet and let you talk, is that a lot of it talks about our ability to recognize what is the future for African people in America and what does the future hold for us. And what is it that we can do to make changes? Because if you seriously think about holding up arms, you know, Greenwood will come up. So if you're going to do something on that order, it has to be done in a different manner, and you need to be well thought out. You need to have allies. Very clearly, we have not had that in the past. And the Native Americans, in a lot of cases, were allies to the African people. We didn't hear that in Nat Turner. Native Americans were involved in the Nat Turner revolt. That's well known. Not a large number of them, but very clearly enough. And then you have to ask yourself the question, the Africans that were escaping the southern plantations of the Carolinas and Georgia, coming down into Florida and connecting with the Seminoles, how were they able to leave and cross and get into Oklahoma without being able to encounter places like Louisiana and some of those other ones that would have definitely fired back? How did they do that? And that's the question that you want to think of. That's a historical, what we call aha question. How did they do that? How were they successful in getting that? How were they successful in getting into Oklahoma and to build property and start lands? What happened? How did it get eased in a way that allowed them to build in the way that they built? So these are questions that maybe we can talk about now as we come up. Remember, this is a think tank, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to raise thought about things and how things worked and didn't work. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to open up lines and take a few comments, and then we're going to go to the top of the hour. It's not quite there yet, but we will be very shortly and see what you have to say. Now, I know, as always, Brother Timothy came on first. So you on first, Brother Timothy. I welcome your comments. You got any thoughts or questions that you have? Brother Timothy? Brother Timothy, you questions? You might have your mic muted. Brother Timothy. Okay. Brother White, Brother Herbie White, what about yourself?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers, and to anyone else on the show.
Good evening. How you doing?
Good evening, sir. Good evening.
I'll go right ahead. That's Brother Timothy is answering the line now, but we'll come back to you, Brother Timothy.
Yes, sir.
Like I said about Greenwood last week, a week or so ago, the wealth and the prosperity in Greenwood, the most important thing about that, it was the culture that created that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Their wealth wasn't built on capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't built on a capitalism system, because the capitalism system is a cutthroat, dog-eat-dog thing. And even though the Kwanzaa didn't exist, the principles of Kwanzaa, the Nguzo Saba, collective work and responsibility and self-determination, those are the things that created Greenwood.
Okay.
That made it work the way it worked. The fact that the brothers had armed themselves to defend their community, not their personal stuff, their community.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that African people have always done in the South. You know about even in Durham place in the South, people took care of other people's children.
Yes, they did.
People raised other people's children. Where I grew up in Brooklyn, if a woman had a child, somebody in the neighborhood who had a child who was 6 months old brought that person their baby clothes, mm-hmm, and gave them their baby clothes so that they wouldn't have to buy them.
Sure did.
I even remember when people got out of jail, everybody came around and gave them money.
Yep, that's culture. That's the culture.
That's the culture. That's not a culture of capitalism. Of that cutthroat thing.
Right.
It's the fact of everybody helping everybody else.
Right.
And that's what the white man is terribly afraid of.
Yes.
That's why he tries to make us our own worst enemies.
Yeah. And we don't need capitalism to survive. We don't need that.
No. No.
Right.
The community can't survive on capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Community can survive because when one person is not doing well, the rest of the community helps them out until they're on their feet.
That's right.
And this keeps repeating itself.
All right. Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, my brother. Thank you. Brother Timothy, go ahead.
Yes, sir. Like what you said, your introduction, you talked about a person like Dr. Andrew Jackson. All that stuff is significant, sir. And I'm going to put my stuff together and put it out that when we look at a place like Tulsa, Oklahoma, we look at, there have been many Wall Streets. And you could probably tell me the one in North Carolina, in Durham. Harlem could be like a Wall Street. And believe it or not, people don't realize it, that when people were kind of chased out of D.C., they went to P.G. County. Mm-hmm. P.G. County right now is one of the richest places in the country where prominent blacks now live. So in 52nd Street, if Dr. Bruce was on the line right now, he could tell you about 52nd Street, what it's like when he was going through it, what it's like now.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, we're going to have our Juneteenth parade there this coming Saturday, and they're going to start at 52nd and Parkside and go all the way to 52nd and Pine. All black businesses that are left, now there's Pakistanis there and there's Asians there. It's not the Wall Street that it was, but
right,
there many Wall Streets we need to talk about. But I'm going to add to that now we have something which is called critical race theory that's out, the 1619, about slavery, and it goes further back than that, according to Elijah Muhammad.
Right.
First slave ship was by John Hawkins, 1555. People give the wrong dates. That's why it's important to do your own research and tell your own history. And I'm saying it to say that the situation that happened in Tulsa is a tragedy, a massacre. And this critical race theory is coming out that white folks in America, in certain states, don't want to hear about what they've done to our people.
Okay. No, and, they don't want to hear
right, that. Right. And my thing is that if you're going to tell the truth, tell the whole truth. And they say some whites are embarrassed. It makes them seem like that they're the hateful group that oppress black people. Well, they want to take that position. I've seen documentaries on white supremacists who brag about oppressing people. I've actually seen them say that. Look, they say that what made us strong is that we were able to take Egypt. If they were so strong, why did they let it happen? What made it so strong, them so strong, they were able to come in America and subdue the Native American and the Moors. What made them, so if they were so great, why did that happen? So when we want to talk about critical race theory, tell the truth. Yeah. Don't hide what happened in Tulsa. Don't hide when you put drugs in neighborhoods like 52nd Street. Don't hide what you did to Move, dropping bomb on Move. Don't hide those things. Come out with it. Don't be ashamed of it. Listen to me. I've seen a 16-year-old girl during the time Hillary Clinton was running, because white people do it to themselves. I was a 16-year-old girl with her mother say, lock that B up. So they teach them racism in their home anyway. So if we're going, like I said, if we're going to tell the truth, let's tell the whole truth. And like your brother said, we had a culture to help one another. We took in our elderly. We looked after our youth.
Right.
So we need to keep that going on. It's bigger. It's bigger. Our situation of how we survive, that's called survival, what we did.
I agree. Okay.
A mechanism.
All right. Thank you, my brother. Go over here. Dr. Bridges, you, what has your research told you about Tulsa that we don't already know? Is there anything else that maybe you have come across that we need to talk about tonight?
There may be a couple of things, but first thing I want to do is commend you for coming up with some good information that you don't usually hear.
Right, thank you.
In your discussion, that was very good. I wanted to bring it up because, you know, That's me. I like to, you know, try to get something new and something different that other people are not talking about. You did go at it from some different perspectives. And I hope my brother, I called him and told him to tune in, the one who had asked us the question about the difference between what happened in Tulsa and what happened in Durham and why it didn't happen in Durham. And he may have a comment later on. I don't know. But I want to commend you on that. Also, I want to just mention, too, that those five so-called Native American nations that went into Oklahoma, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Coromantha, the Creek, the Seminoles, they many of them, as you mentioned, too, had been down in Florida.
Right.
And there's a great personality leader of one of those of the Seminoles by the name of John Horse, that some of our listeners might want to look into his history. He's very interesting, John Horse. But he was a Seminole leader. His mother was African, but his father was Seminole mixed with Spanish. So John Horse was a black man, and he teamed up with another Native American called Osceola, and another brother by the name of Wildcat. And the three of them fought against the Spanish down in Florida, and they also went to Washington, D.C. at one point and even spoke to the President of the United States. And eventually John Horse even traveled over into Mexico, and there's remnants of him having his descendants are still in Mexico right now. They've become what are called the Mascogos, who are the black Mexicans. So there's a good connection between the Seminole in Florida and Oklahoma, and then down into Mexico. And you got made another good point with the mentions you made, and I wanted to just mention William Katz, K-A-D-Z, a Caucasian writer, has done a great deal of work on blacks and Indians and the relationship between black and Indian. Yeah, he had a good book called Black, Red, and Deadly, where he talked about Bass Reeves, because Bass Reeves, of course, as we know, the Lone Ranger, Bass Reeves works that Oklahoma territory, too, as a marshal in Muscogee. He was a part of that Muscogee force because, as you said, blacks in Oklahoma had their own police forces, the men were armed, and Bass Reeves also worked that era. And another person, too, as I end up here, is Drusilla Houston, who wrote the book The Wonderful Ethiopians.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to mention her because she lived in that Oklahoma area, and she wrote for a newspaper called The Black Dispatch. And one thing we know is true about African organizations in the world, they always have an organ of propaganda, which at most points, at least in earlier history before the internet, the organ of propaganda was always a newspaper.
Right.
And Drusilla Houston wrote for the Dispatch, and of course Elijah Muhammad used to write for the Chicago Defender, I think, and then there was an Afro-American newspaper.
Right.
So newspapers have always been an organ to get the word out or to propagandize for the upliftment of black people, and the same thing was going on too in Black Wall Street. Thank you very much.
Right, great. That's great. And you're right, Brother Dr. Richards. I'm glad you mentioned that book, the one that you said you talked about, that Black Heritage. It's called Black Indians, A Hidden Heritage. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I love that book. And there are a couple of others, and this is for our audience, you know, who might want to look at that and kind of do some research in that area. There are a couple of real good pieces out there. That are very good. There's one by an African Native American sister. She wrote one called Race to the Sun.
Right.
Yeah, her name is, I think it's Roan Horse or Rain Horse or something like that.
Yeah, there's something like that.
That's a good piece as well.
It is.
Yeah, so, you know, there's some things that you can look at.
Go ahead. Yeah, just like you and I were talking, too, I think it was yesterday or sometime, we were talking about a lot of these Native Americans. They haven't always been on the sides of black people. It's kind of a mixed story. Some were, and even now today, too, that's what I wanted to mention. In Oklahoma, many of the black Cherokees are fighting for equal rights and to get some of the land that they're owed. And some of the Cherokees don't want to have it. So the black man just catch hell. It's okay, whether with the Indians or whether with the Spanish or the British or wherever. That seems to be the case. And one other point I want to make, and that is, this original continent, as you asked me the other day, was inhabited by so-called Native Africans who were called Indians by Europeans,
right.
But they came across the area that connects Alaska to Asia called the Bering Strait, B-E-R-I-N-G.
Right.
They came from Africa, and when they came across the Bering Strait, which at one time was frozen and it was ice there, so you could walk across from Asia into the continent of North America, and they began to settle in the area of Washington State and Oregon and California, and then they went on down into Guatemala and Honduras and along the land bridge, and then they went on down into South America, and they became the Aztecs, the Incas, the Olmecs, and those heads that Ivan Van Sertima used to talk about, those were the original black people land. And these so-called Indians that we have are just a mix. This red man is a mixture of Europeans with the original black people who were the indigenous people of this continent and the South American continent and of the whole earth, the indigenous people. That trois traveled everywhere.
Right, that's right. And see, one of the things that I wanted our audience to recognize as well, one of the reasons why we didn't hear a lot about this and the involvement of the intermixture of the Native Americans and the Africans, and as Dr. Bridges said, even the European bloodlines and that, is that that group of people, that classification of human beings, will fight you back.
Exactly.
They will fight you. And they know it. Europeans know that. And they understood that. And so when you start seeing some of the mistreatment, when those Native Americans did that ghost dance, there's some history in there that you can trace that ghost that someone's mic is open again and it's really making noise, a lot of noise. And so when you trace that history like that, you will trace that back to warrior class of people. And because the Europeans are warriors and they're constantly always doing things, and so they have to be careful of who they're running up against, they downplayed that, a lot of that. And a lot of our bloodline to this day is warrior blood from Africa. That's why it was very important to shut down. If you think about it for a minute, one of the large warrior classes of Africa settled in South Carolina, in that area, that rice culture area. That African country where they were warriors. And so a lot of those revolts that happened between North Carolina and the Virginia area and South Carolina and North Carolina, those were fighting groups. There's a good book I ran across, I don't know how many, that relates very clearly to you and Dr. Bridges as well as Herbie White. It was about the Lumbee Indians in the Jim Crow South and how they ended up with this race identity and the making of their nation. They were clearly suppressed because they were fighters. And I don't know the author, but I can't remember. But take a look at the book called The Lumbee Indians in the Jim Crow South. I know that part of it. It's a long title, but it's called The Lumbee Indians in the Jim Crow South. And you'll see that was a fear. And so they quickly had to place them in a certain way where their captivity would be understood. Have you ever read that, Dr. Bridges, or do you know much about the history of the Lumbee? Because you know where the Lumbee are down in Lumberton. Dr. Bridges, you still there?
Oh, I had myself on mute. I didn't want to make noise. Okay. They're down in Robeson County, down in North Carolina, down near Fayetteville and near the South Carolina line.
Right. That's right. That's the Lumbee.
Yeah, the Lumbee. And they're fighting right now, too, Dr. Rogers, to become recognized as a Native American tribe, as the Cherokee have. They haven't quite gotten that status yet, but they're fighting to get that.
Right. Exactly. Exactly right.
And, you know, since you mentioned Native Americans now, and I just mentioned John Horse actually led, and the black Seminoles led the largest slave revolt in the whole United States of America in terms of size and people and what actually happened. They fought against the colonists and everything. John Horse is a story that could be told. And this is why, as I always think about our African American writers and directors and theater people, how if they knew our history, they would have so much to draw on, and they would not have to put anything out, such as the Black Panther in a fictional land called Wakanda, because, you know, they could do a story of John Horse fighting right. against the Spanish down in the Everglades in Florida, right. which is a true story, and the slavery folk, these were runaway slaves, you see. So they would make good stories if we had a knowledge of who we are as a people, or if they at least had a connection with some historians and people who would tell them about something else other than Madea and Tyler Perry's other stories and those kind of things. You know, so much truth, right. as Brother Timothy said, we could, right, okay.
That's
I'm
exactly.
finished. I'm listening for the rest of the time. I'm still on with
no,
you.
No, I want you to stay on. That's good. I appreciate that. But you're right. And that's one of the reasons for the discussion tonight. We ear, and I must say some of our black historians have eared terribly by not incorporating the Native American African relationship into the story of our history, because it's all intertwined in there. And there are some excellent research that has been done over the years to deal with that. And a lot of it is what we're talking about. There were things that were done specifically because they did not want to bring the Native Americans and Africans together. That's too much war blood. Please mute your mic again to someone who's in the background. There's too much war blood And so they need to do that. There's one book that I know about, for instance, and I looked it up in terms of today that I did miss. I just found the name of it. It's called The Color of the Land, Race, Nation, and the Politics of Land Ownership in Oklahoma. And, and that gets right into the heart of what happened in Tulsa with those Native Americans. And see, we didn't get that history. And then there was another book called That the Blood Stay Pure. That's the name of the book, That the Blood Stay Pure. African Americans, Native Americans, and the Predicament of Race and Identity in Virginia. That's again, and that's and we talk about these states. This is that fight back country. You know, Virginia was fight back, and we know that South Carolina was fight back, and a lot of that was because we did have an ally. It was an underground ally, but they were allies to help fight back and to overturn this horrible system. So, okay, with that, I'm going to take a quick break. I'm not going to do our long thing that we normally do. And I'm going to come back and open up the lines. We have several folk more that are on. I want to get Brother Ricketts. So glad he's able to join us tonight. I'm going to talk to him a little bit, see what he feels. I got Brother Kwasi Kraft, who has his own program. Let him talk a little bit about that as well. We're going to come back and deal with that. But let's take a quick break so that we can kind of get behind some things. So let's do that, and we'll be right back. Time for an Awakening Media Lineup. All of our times are Eastern Standard. On Mondays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspective with host Brother Oshie. On Monday evenings from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds with host Brother Jihad Ahmed. On Monday evenings from 8 to 9 p.m., Black Therapy Central with hosts Dr. Mawaya Cambone and Sister Nataki Cambone. On Monday evenings from 9 to 10 p.m., on the first and third Mondays of each month, Conversation Reparations. Conversation Reparations. On Tuesday evening, from 8 to 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. On Wednesday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives with host Brother Ocean. On Fridays, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives with host Brother Ocean. From 8 to 10 p.m., on Friday evenings, time for an awakening with host Brother Elliot Booker and his co-host Brother Richard. On Saturdays, from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., Black Sister Talk with host LaWanda Chambers. And at 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. on Saturday evening, the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee with host Dr. Janine James, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister D.D. Conley. And on Sunday, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot his co-host, Brother Richard. These are our lineup times. We thank you for your patronage, and please, by all means, check us out.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Okay, brothers and sisters, we are back and we are talking about the Tulsa uprising, but we are also including in our conversation those things that have been missed, those things that we may not have covered during the celebration time that we were looking at the 100-year activity of this horrible, horrible incident. Brother Ricketts, how you doing tonight? Glad to see you with us.
I'm fine. I tuned in a little late, so I don't know exactly everything that you've covered. But I was here thinking for a second, and this crossed my mind. And I'm thinking about what we need is perhaps a new Homestead Act. The Homestead Act that gave every white citizen or person in this country 160 acres.
Right.
Why not have laws and legislation dealing with that aspect of it as part of a reparation package?
Mm-hmm.
And that is that laws... having a new Homestead Act will also empower black people in this country. And this is what we need, because we know land is tied to wealth. And if land is tied to wealth and your intentions are just, as they've told us for 400 or plus years, then why not have a new Homestead Act to equalize the playing field, even though the playing field will never be equal.
Right.
You go back 400 years and you see how far they've come in 400 years. And then you bring that 400 years to the present. We've not gone very far. And then now we project another 400 years. And at the rate that changes do occur, I don't see much have changed in those 1,200 years.
That's a lot of reparations, isn't it?
You know, what I'm saying is that reparation, how long should reparation last? It should last forever, because if you're in a race with a man and he takes off 240 years, he has a 240-day head start. Let's say, and you're both traveling at, let's say, 10 miles an hour. You never catch up. You never catch up in the scheme of things. Mm-hmm. So reparation has to be forever, for as long as we are alive, and we're in this society. Reparation has to be perpetual. It has to be perpetual.
That is the only way.
And 400 years from now, you still will not have caught up.
Exactly.
You still will not have caught up. So what we need is a new Homestead Act. Mm-hmm. We need to empower black people with land. They have millions of acres of land in this country that belong to the federal government that doesn't really, that they took, right, that they claim. But then what we need is another Homestead Act, is the argument that I'm proposing, you know, to the panel or to anyone that wants to jump in or want to elaborate or, you know, what they think. You think it's a good idea, a great idea, or an absurd point.
Right.
But I think it's valid.
Exactly. That's a good point, because definitely that does raise a lot of questions. I remember, very clearly that's what contributed to a lot of the Caucasian entitlement factors that, you know, we saw.
Exactly. And that is that their wealth was based on centuries of free land.
Right. That's right.
We've never had. I mean, the 40 acres and the mule was a proposal that never, of course, we know, never came to fruition. But then why don't we have a 160-acre Homestead Act for black people?
Exactly right.
That's if you want justice in a society, then you have to start. You have to start from the basis of land. Because that's how they acquired wealth.
That has to be.
And if they acquired wealth through land, there's only one way we can acquire wealth through land. And 400 years of the Homestead Act, I think, is appropriate. Exactly. Or even more, for as long as it takes. Mm-hmm. Like I said, at the rate that the race is being run, you can't catch up.
And then that leads into the thought.
It is impossible to catch up. You know, what we have to do, we have to do in the moment. We have to deal with the moment. And what we need economic wealth. And economic wealth, as we know, in the society that we live in,
is land.
It comes through land.
Right.
So why not a new proposal for a new Homestead Act that deals with us, because we were not included in initial 160-acre Homestead Act. It was for whites only.
Exactly.
So it is only appropriate that they deal with this new Homestead Act. That is what we need. Because we need wealth, and we need wealth through man.
Right. I agree.
And this is the only way we can grow our own food. We can start our own communities.
And that's true. Let me go over here to Brother Otis Griffin. Brother Griffin, you had some points you made about some of that land and the trillions of dollars. You said, I think one of the economists, Dr. Darity, made some statements about that.
Oh, yes, sir. As a matter of fact, I was going to recommend a book because it covers a lot of things that people have been talking about.
Okay.
But I wanted to
talk just a little bit louder, Brother Griffin. Could you talk just a little bit louder? Brother Griffin? Oh, I lost him. Okay. His voice was fading a little bit. When he comes back on, I'll grab him. Brother Lush, any thoughts you have about this money and what was going on?
Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Doc Rogers. I'm just kind of listening in today, and as I'm listening, I'm just kind of wondering. I wonder if we could have a somewhat modern-day kind of exodus to one of those towns, like, say, Reedysville, and start to populate it and begin this process of the kinds and types of things that we talk about with regards to self-determination and building for ourselves and separating out. I just wonder what it would look like. You know, I've read basically everything what everyone else has read, which, by the way, Doc Rogers, if you would be so kind as to put those books on, you know, kind of email a copy of or the names, the titles. And one other text that I would like to add to that list would be from Jack Forbes. Jack Forbes had a book.
Say that name again.
Jack D. Forbes. Douglas Forbes, I think, is his name.
Okay.
Yeah. And one of the books that he had written, which was very interesting, was about Africans and Native Americans.
Okay.
The language of race and the evolution of the red black peoples. So I'd like to add that to that list well.
Yeah, I will make that
available. But, you know, from what we've all talked about, I know Brother Timothy had said you have to tell the truth, right?
Right.
I think this is an instance where we really have to live the truth. And the best way to do that is to be in those areas and actually build it. I've been on the outside of Oklahoma all of my life. So I wonder what life would be like being there. And I'm just going to throw this out. Would anybody have connections to anyone in any of those black towns at all? I would love to connect with people there and just maybe start a conversation or start some sort of relationship of sorts at all. So that's what I have to offer for this evening.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I think that's possible because now with some of the discussion that's going on, and those are not the, you know, Oklahoma wasn't the only one. We know Mississippi, Mound Bayou, and that town is still there. And it's still a black town. They're struggling, but they're there. And then Kansas.
There's even one here in Alabama called Anniston, Alabama. So
we talked about that the other day.
Yep, that's right. So, yeah, you're right. I think that is possible. That's a doable goal, Brother Lush. It really is. It's a doable goal. Okay, let me go to, back to Brother Griffin. He's back online. Brother Griffin?
Can you hear me?
Oh, real good now. I hear you real good.
Okay, I had to switch to the phone. I'm sorry. I wanted to bring up a point. You're bringing them. I was going to say, I put some stuff in there telling you about Dr. Darity's book, From Here to Equality. Is only 13 chapters, about 400 pages, but it actually covers a lot of the stuff we're talking about. For instance, when you talk, I found this out from about 4 years ago, so I've actually researched about 25 of them.
Okay.
There was over 100 massacres everywhere from Oregon all the way over to Rhode Island. Two notable ones, Elaine, Arkansas, and another in Ocoee, Florida. Now, the reason I say that is because by the time I got to about the 20th one, there's another thing that we've been missing, and I brought this up to Dr. Darity once I saw the commonality. We talk about these things in the papers. They were called riots. Yeah, so it made it look like the black people were doing something nefarious.
Mm-hmm.
But another common trait in every one, I mean, the majority of the ones that I've gone through, the 25 or so that I've gone through, and y'all name some of them. But rather than just go out and attack black people, those people were actually deputized under the color of law.
Right.
They knew what the law was, and they knew how to give themselves immunity from any prosecution. That is something, if you don't look at the commonality in all of those stories, and I didn't find it out until you read about just an article about them, and all you get is there was a riot, now finally they call it a massacre.
Mm-hmm.
But in so many of them now, like Ocoee and Elaine, historians have gone back and gone through the records and showed that there were actually conversations about first being deputized before you go out and commit the atrocities they did. So we got to take that into account.
That's a good
point. If you just look at the gruesomeness, you forget the fact that these people didn't just go out and kill. They were deputized to go out and kill.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And which made it legal.
So we have to take a little bit different approach to how we see the enemy. I'm kind of like Brother Elliot with that. You have to realize just what extremes these people will go through. And to bring that back to modern days, that's why in just about everything I deal with when it comes to white people, or whether it's contracts or anything else, what we seem to neglect is you can't just take a deal or something like that Fake Step Act. You actually have to go through the details and find out what the impact is going to be on you, because these people always leave loopholes to leave you holding the bag. That's all I got to say.
Good
Love
point.
Your work.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And you're right. And I think that is important for our audience, is that there are a lot of times there are factors that undergird a lot of the activity. And another one, and we haven't talked about this one either, there's just so much to talk about. Another one is the coming of alcohol into existence around the 1920s. You had a whole bunch of drunks walking the streets of these small towns would kill you in a minute. And that was another thing, that the incident in Nebraska, Omaha, Nebraska, Will Brown, what they did to him. Those men who took Will Brown out of that building and lynched him, burnt him, cut off his penis, and shot him over 100 times were all given alcohol as a booster. And then to do that. And then, you know, you had the prohibition area was going on around that time. That has to be factored in to the history of that. They have to factor that in. And even down to the point of things like our forms of activity that we liked and the things they're doing. Baseball, the Negro baseball leagues had to come into towns where they were hostile. And there's a whole history on that and how that was done and some of the things that they would encounter. So they ended up choosing towns where blacks were a lot more affluent and were able to do some things, and that's Kansas. This is where Kansas City comes in because you have to ask yourself, how in the world did the Kansas City Monarchs able to have existed as long as it did and the way it did? Well, because they were run by people of wealth and power, and that mostly was undertakers. And a lot of the black churches had a lot to do with the Negro baseball and the reform. We had a brother that was a part of the Negro Baseball League. He was one of the latter ones. He was a young person when he came into existence, but he's here in Milwaukee. He's about 80-something years old, 90, thinking about bringing him back on one day and talk about Negro baseball again. So, yeah, we're right, Brother Griffin, that you have to look at a lot of those factors that has a lot to do with what's going on in these situations. I've got a Durham call, 919-477. Did you want to say anything, my sister? I know you. I haven't talked to you in a while. Good to see you on. Appreciate you coming. Yes.
Just listening.
Okay, just listening. All right, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Okay, Brother Kwasi Crabb, how are you doing tonight, my brother?
Hey, I'm doing all right, Doc Rogers. I am doing all right.
Any thoughts you have? You down there from Mississippi. Do you know where Mound Bayou near you?
Mound Bayou?
Yeah, Mississippi. Are you familiar with that?
Oh. Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we were from out of Pickens, Holmes County, Kosciuszko, Jackson. So all those areas are relatively close and stuff.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that was talking about, what was you talking about, the act in regards to getting land?
Yes.
And one of the comments that was made was that Brother Ricky, when he made a comment in reference that if they want to do right or if they want to be right by us, and the thing is that I... they don't want to be right, and they never do, and they never have. And so when you keep bringing up all the ugly things that you might not have mentioned, you know, like how alcohol played a part in it and stuff like that, you know, there's just no level that they haven't gone in the things that they've done. You know, just even if you think about picnics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're taking our babies' heads and stuff and throwing balls at them and stuff as fun. Mm-hmm. You know, so all these different things and trying to get some rationale and reasoning in regards to reparations. I mean, everybody else pretty much on the planet has got reparations, and with the exception of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's not a direction that they're looking to move.
Okay.
So,
all right. Yeah, that's true, and you're right about that. That's why I'm. If anybody do reparations, I think there's some effort to make this Tulsa situation respond to that as well. I don't know where they are or in terms of the work that needs to be done to get it to happen. But you know, very clearly, that's one that I've heard of.
Yeah, lately. I mean, you know, and one of the other things that they keep talking about is that they don't have records. And I was talking to Brother Lush the other day, and we were talking about in Alabama, there's family members that, and then they even have the former slaveholder's names and information, and they worked for him all this time, and then they met relatives of this person, and it was a white male, and he made it. They met with the families, and his statement was basically, "Well, that wasn't me. I'm sorry what happened." And you know, they basically embraced him and stuff like that, and they weren't talking about reparations.
Okay.
They were just talking about an apology.
Okay.
And you know, and that to me, that's kind of one of the other things that they've always been able to manipulate us some kind of way, thinking that hugs versus property and everything else. I mean,
okay,
that was troubling to me.
All right, what are you talking about next Thursday? I mean, this Thursday, rather. I'm sorry.
Well, this Thursday, I'm going to have a good friend of mine, Queen Mother Cordelia Taylor. She started the Family House in Milwaukee. She's a former nurse practitioner.
Okay.
And she's actually, she's been to the White House a couple times. But one of the things that she did, she was distraught about a lot of the things that were going on in the neighborhood, where, you know, a lot of the low income areas and stuff, and you know, you had taverns on every corner and stuff like that. So she developed a program and a situation where she could get these places removed and torn down out of the area, build up a center for seniors where they could stay and also engage with the kids in the community.
Okay,
and stuff. So we're going to have a discussion, you know, in regards to, you know, helping helps heal.
Okay.
You know, and
that's
and
what
the family
brother,
house is a
that's
big
what
part
brother,
of that.
Brother White was saying about culture. A lot of the things we do and the successes we have come out of culture. And very
mm-hmm.
clearly, family house was the result of a very strong culture working. You're right. Well, thank you so much, Brother Kwasi. I appreciate it. Brother Timothy, you said you had something you want to add?
Yes, sir, I sure do. The messenger talked about in a lesson that the Native Americans were exiled out of Egypt and they walked the Bering Strait. So I just want to talk about that. That was his reference. And I also want to talk about the stuff that I read on a Native American. And I had read where Lee's soldiers want to go up in the hills of Tennessee
mm-hmm.
to fight the Native Americans. And Lee said they will wipe us out, the guerrilla warfare.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about those Native Americans from the ethnic nation. I call them ethnic nations, and the ones that will fight. The same thing with the Central Indians in Florida,
right.
But the guerrilla warfare. They couldn't get up in the swamps. And, of course, you had those Native Americans that hit Nat Turner after his strong and righteous rebellion.
Right.
So you had those Native Americans that were rumble, man.
Mm-hmm.
And were rumble with us.
Right. And you talked about Tennessee. Andrew Jackson, who was out of Tennessee, president, when former president, on the $20 bill, he was one of the largest slaveholders on the planet. And not only did he own lots of slaves, he had a lot of black babies from the women on that Burbage plantation that I talked about mm-hmm. before, where he fathered these black kids and then put them in slavery. And not only that, he was a pedophile and a child molester because he had sex with his brother's daughter, who the brother had fathered, Jackson's father, and then he had sex with her and had a baby too. So it's a lot of messed up stuff around that whole thing. And that's one of the deals with slavery. Is that it has so much of that kind of history entwined that we have to pay attention to in terms of our assessment and analysis of things. Sister,
what a hypocrite! What a hypocrite and a devil!
Yeah, that's right. No doubt about it. No doubt about it. Sister Dee Dee, you have any words you want to add?
I apologize. I was muted. I just love the program tonight. I just love it. Very interesting, and it just never seems to amaze me our stories that come out, not his stories, but our stories. And just, I mean, never taught this in school. Our children aren't learning this. This is really amazing. And it would be even better amazing if we could just come back, unite, and just start having our own. Thank you so much, you, Dr. Bridges, Dr. Lush, family, period. Thank you so much for our story and getting our story out there. And I'm going to try my best to have more people listen, especially the younger ones. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the work you do, too. You do some powerful work as well. Sister Dee Dee is a part of the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee. She handles the ancestral profile for them. So we appreciate you, too, as well. Thank you so much, my sister. Okay, 414-581, is there anything you'd like to add to this conversation? 414-581.
I'm enjoying the conversation.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I think you went out on it. Say that once more. Hello? Yep, you might have
joined the conversation tonight, particularly as there's been a lot of conversation about Tulsa. And I heard something that I think is an area of history that we may not have considered. And that was, or that has been those whites that were also living during the time who have shared some of these stories with their families, and those family members being willing to talk about that which their family members have shared. And that it has led to the realization that there were probably more people who have who succumbed during this period than was initially reported. Family members who have been interviewed telling that their grandparents mentioned that people were buried in various locations.
Right.
And just as we have not felt comfortable talking about some of these experiences, I think that there are probably a wealth of information that has been covered. I don't know so much deliberately, but just things that were talked about amongst families that will also serve to add to the story,
right.
to the stories that we need to hear. And so I'm eager to see what happens, or if anything will come of families being encouraged to share some of the events in such a way that it will help to fill in some of the gaps.
I like that.
These stories.
Yeah, I like that. That's, you're right. And I like to see that done. Some of that personal family history is really important, and we're kind of losing that. A lot of it was being done sometimes in the family reunions when they were picking up and getting stronger. A lot of families were looking and researching their history, and they were basically amateur historians, but they were doing it and revealing some things that the children coming behind would need to know. So you're right. That needs to be started again, Dr. James. Thank you so much for that. Appreciate that. area code 414-507. Anything you'd like to add to our conversation as we close out? 414-507. Okay, guess you just listening. Well, my brothers and sisters, we are at that time. You know, let me go quickly. There's a 505 area code 340. I overlooked you. I'm sorry. Is there something that you'd like to add to this conversation?
Yeah, what I'd like to say is, are you the brother from lived in Durham for 18 years?
Yes, I am.
Are you familiar with Miss Maggie Bryant?
What's her name?
Maggie Bryant.
Maggie Bryant. Dr. Bridges, you know that name?
She'll be 106 years old this coming July 2nd. Is there any way you can have her on your program?
I would if she could. Do you know someone that has a connection with her?
Well, she's my aunt. That's why I'm calling.
Oh, okay. If you can help, I have your number here. I'll take your number down. Yeah. Is it okay if I call you during the week?
Not a problem. She worked at, what's it, North Carolina Central? Is that North Carolina College?
North Carolina Central, right. That's exactly right.
She was the chief librarian for like over 60 years there.
Oh, and, wow. Okay. Dr. Bridges.
In the last couple of years, they've been having a tribute for her from the state. I think she's the oldest living female in the state of North Carolina at this present time.
Okay, so Maggie Bryant. All right, that's excellent.
Maggie Bryant, and you can call, your name again?
William Rogers.
Okay, Mr. Rogers, Brother Rogers, you can call me and leave a message. I get back, I'll give you all the information because I understand. I just spoke to her a couple of days ago. I understand they're having and she said you can find all the information you want about her still up on YouTube.
Okay. Well, I am going to definitely do that. That would be excellent. Yeah. Excellent.
Because I asked Aunt Maggie one day, I said, Aunt Maggie, when she was born in 1915, I said, who was the president? I think she said Grover Cleveland.
Okay, yeah, that's the 19. So she's 106, yeah, that's 19.
She should be 106 this next month, July the 2nd.
Yeah,
so I just spoke to her a couple of days ago.
She remembers World War One. She's right, exactly.
She's very coherent, and, she likes to talk. So I was just listening. When you said Dora, I said, well, maybe you can interview her over the phone because she's interested.
Well, I will definitely make preparations to do that. So you will be hearing from me very shortly. Okay?
Yes, sir. Okay, my brother.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that is it. We have come to the closing hour. I appreciate all of you. Don't forget our Thursday program on 6 o'clock here, a Time for Awakening. And then on Saturday, we have the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee with Dr. Jenny James as host. I think they're going to do something on
Juneteenth.
Dr. Bridges is going to be our special guest on that program. He's going to talk about significance of Juneteenth and what is it that we are not looking at about when we do deal with Juneteenth. There's the hidden history there as well, so he's going to come on and be doing that. And then the Black Sister Talk that comes on at 3 o'clock Central Time as well. So we appreciate all of you. This has been a wonderful discussion. There's obviously more of it that we could cover, but as you know, the 2 hours does not do it. Remember, all of our programs are archived, and you can go back and you can listen to tonight's broadcast or either go to the Black Reality Think Tank Facebook page called Black Reality Think Tank, and the post will be there as well. We have been having some difficulty. A lot of our programs that we post, you can't play them. There's some problems going on, but Brother Elliot out of Philadelphia is working on that. But the meanwhile, you can go to our Facebook page and get the program. So have a wonderful week. Thank you so much. Enjoy some of this nice warm weather, and we will see you on next Tuesday. Thank you.
This morning.